You're listening to the We Lead Well podcast, where well-being matters. The show is brought to you in partnership with Transform Education Coaching, headteacherchat.com, and the Teach Well Alliance. Enjoy the show. Happy New Year, everyone. Welcome to the first episode of the We Lead Well podcast of 2021. I'm really excited about the guests that I've got planned for this year. Some really interesting guests. The first of which is Dr. Helen Kelly, who's on the show today. Helen was a trailblazer in international school education during her leadership career, which spanned over 15 years. She led schools in Asia and Europe to become well-being focused and future ready. And that's one of the reasons that I've got Helen on the show. I first encountered her on social media, where she was sharing the research that she'd done into the impact of COVID on school leaders. And I thought it would be really great to get her on the show to share the research that she's done and to share her ideas for how school leaders can improve their own well-being during this crisis. She actually retired from her role in schools in 2020. And as I said before, she's a researcher and she writes on a whole range of educational topics. She has a website called The Positive Principle, where she does a blog every week, and there are some very useful and insightful blogs on there that I am sure you will enjoy reading. Helen really focuses on what school leaders can do to improve their own well-being and the well-being of their staff. But she also recently has had a focus on how governors can support head teachers to improve well-being. And this is something that we talk about in the interview. And she's got quite a number of ideas for how governors can better support well-being, specifically of head teachers, who can then follow this up with the way that they improve the well-being of the senior leaders in the school and the well-being of the staff in the school. I am sure that you will enjoy this first interview of 2021. So here we go. I'll introduce you to Dr. Helen Kelly. Enjoy. Welcome to the show, Dr. Helen Kelly. How are you?
I'm really well, thank you. Actually, I've come to you from installing insulation in the camper van that we're building outside in the freezing cold.
Oh, well, I have that written down as my interesting things about you, because you are converting a Mercedes Sprinter into a camper van, aren't you? And that's one of my Pinterest favourite things to do, is to look at conversions of vans. So
we're doing that. So I've left my husband outside in the cold. I'm in North Wales, it's about 4 degrees this morning, so I'm glad that I've had an excuse to come in and sit in the warmth and have a cup of tea.
Yeah, so thank you. You're not far away from me, actually. I'm in Manchester. I love North Wales. We've just bought a caravan, actually, and we are going to put it on a site in Anglesey.
So, oh,
yeah, North Wales is one of my favourite ever places. The reason that I've got you on the podcast today is because I think it might have been on Twitter or LinkedIn, an infographic that you'd done that explored senior leaders' responses to the COVID crisis. You'd done a survey, hadn't you? And there were some really interesting responses that I'd seen on that. And that was what made me look into you and want to get you on the show, because I know that you've done a lot of research into well-being for senior leaders, and I thought it'd be really useful for our listeners to hear your experience and your advice. One of the things that I'd really like to just ask you to do is, can you just tell the listeners a little bit about yourself? Because I know you've got a very broad and varied career behind you, so can you just fill us in on that, please?
Of course, yeah. So teaching wasn't my first career. I was a solicitor in the English legal profession for 10 years, and I worked for trade union members who'd had accidents at work or suffered from industrial diseases. And I think that's where my interest in workplace wellbeing began. Yeah. But then in 1999, I requalified as a teacher along with my husband, who did the same. He was an engineer, so that we could travel and work. And we spent the last 20 years more or less working in overseas international schools, although I did have a 2-year stint in the UK, which I found incredibly hard. And of those 20 years I've been working in international schools, I've been a principal, or, you know, effectively a school, for 15 years in 3 countries. First of all, in Thailand, in Bangkok, and then in Berlin, and most recently in Hong Kong. And I was in Hong Kong for 4 years. In my 3rd year, I suffered an occupational burnout, which I don't have any kind of qualms about sharing. And at the same time, because I was suffering from chest pain, I was diagnosed with heart disease.
Wow.
And so I took the decision, even though I was only 55 at the time, that life's too short. And because I'm someone who's always had such an interest in well-being, that I wasn't going to carry on working myself into the ground. So I worked 12 months notice. And in June this year, I retired from my work in school. But my interest in senior leader well-being goes back to around about 7 years ago, when I started studying for my doctoral, my EdD and my doctoral thesis. And it was during a time when I was working in a school in Berlin, when there was a lot going on and I was finding it hard and I was stressed. And I had no intention of my thesis being anything to do with well-being, but somehow I just got drawn into that over a period of time, based upon my own personal needs and curiosity about, are other people suffering the way that I'm suffering? Well, what can we do about this? And then it became a kind of passion. And then I became a leader in that field, because there aren't really many other people around the world doing this. And so I set up my blog, The Positive Principle. And in the last few months, because of the COVID crisis, there's been even more interest than there has been over the last few years in how we can support leader well-being. So for the past few months, while I've been retired, in inverted commas, I've been speaking with people on almost a daily basis, from school senior leaders all around the world, about this. Yeah, and I'm also, fingers crossed, writing a book.
Oh, brilliant. And that will be for senior leaders?
Yes, yes. So that's out for peer review with a major publisher at the moment. And I expect to hear by about the end of January whether they're going to take it up. If they don't and I can't get other publishers interested, then I've decided I'm going to self-publish on Amazon. A lot of people do that these days. And so it's probably going to be about autumn by the time my book comes out. But yeah, it's focused upon working title of something like School Leaders Matter, Addressing the Stress at the Heart of the Leadership Crisis, something like that.
Yeah, and that's, I think that's one of the things that I found, and I've mentioned this on the podcast before, so the listeners will have heard me go on about this before, but I found that there was a level of pressure and stress that I could cope with. And it was before my divorce, when I was married and I had help at home. And then when I separated from my husband, the level of stress became unmanageable. And I'm really interested in where the tipping point is for senior leaders, you know, before you, because I, like you, I ended up at a point of complete and utter burnout. I'd been so passionate about the job and I absolutely loved being a senior leader. And then all of a sudden, I found myself sitting in my office, paralyzed, just unable to do anything. I'd sit staring at the computer screen thinking, I've got so many things that I should be doing. I've got a to-do list as long as my arm. And yet I just couldn't do anything because I'd reached that point of utter burnout. Where do you see that tipping point being? And how can we as senior leaders identify that we're heading towards that point? Because I think there were a lot of red flags that when I look back, I go, oh yeah, I should have noticed that. I should have seen that. And I didn't. And I think I thought it was other things that were causing my issues. Yeah. And then when I got to the point of absolute burnout, there was no turning back for me. That was it for me. I'm not a deputy head anymore. And
that's familiar to me. I recognise that. Well, I think, first of all, a good starting point is to say that in the summer of 2019, occupational burnout was recognised by the World Health Organization as an occupational disease for the first time. So it is a thing. And burnout is a word that's massively overused. And when we talk about occupational burnout, you know, the listeners can go and look it up, but there are a number of symptoms recognized by the World Health Organization as being what is official burnout, rather than just, you know, we're very stressed. And what you identify as one of them is this kind of paralysis, or maybe some level of confused thinking, so that you're not able to operate at the level that you could operate at before. Another symptom or kind of warning sign is just complete exhaustion. And then the one that was, you know, and also becoming very emotional, which is something I recognize.
Yeah.
But the other one that I recognized, and that was how I knew for me that this was a burnout and it wasn't just becoming completely exhausted, is this cynicism, this kind of stopping believing in what we're doing. And I got to a point, actually quite a long time, maybe a year before I burnt out.
Sorry, you've put your hand over the microphone, so we just missed that last bit that you said. Yeah.
So what I was saying was, I got to a point where about a year before I was diagnosed with the burnout, where I felt that I didn't believe in what we were doing anymore, and what we were doing didn't accord with my values anymore. And, you know, values are everything, aren't they, to school leaders? The reason we work ourselves into the ground is because we believe that what we are doing is worthwhile. And when you stop believing that what you are doing is worthwhile, that's the point at which you've burnt out. So I think those are the warning signs that people can look for. And for me, those came a long way before I, you know, officially was diagnosed with a burnout. Also, what you just said, something you just said resonated with me as well. It's like I was blaming other things, and I guess to some extent I was blaming other people. And I had a lot of confrontation and conflict with my immediate line managers. So in international schools, they tend to be through schools. So, you know, starting at age 3, going through to age 18. So my role was principal of the primary school, which was 1,000 students, but the whole school was 1,800 kids. And so you also have a secondary principal, and then you have a head of school who's over the whole school. It's a little bit like you sometimes have in academies in England, but it's not as common as it is in international schools. And I found myself in confrontation with my head of school and was constantly blaming him for all of my stress. Whereas now, when I look back, I realize that I was in overdrive and I was spinning off out of control for a whole load of reasons. To come back to your original question, though, what about the tipping point? There's no easy answer to that, because what we need to understand about school leader well-being, exactly the same as for teacher well-being, is that it's different for everybody. And no one-size-fits-all approach works. And everybody's experience is different. And the reason for that is because we all have different levels of resilience. You know, resilience is another one of those words, isn't it? Like burnout, that's banded around so much these days. There's been a lot of research in the last 10 years about resilience from scientists and psychologists, and they still don't know as much as they would like to know. But what we know is that some resilience may be genetic. Some resilience comes from our upbringing. And some resilience can be learned. And that's why there's a lot of emphasis upon pupil resilience and how we can build that in through our programs in school. And so the level of resilience that each individual has is different. And therefore their tolerance level and their tipping point will be different. And things that some people might find incredibly stressful, other people, you know, be like water off a duck's back. And it's interesting, in the research that you mentioned that I recently undertook, 721 school leaders from around the world, mostly senior leaders, took part in this 37-question survey. And it was very, very few, but in the qualitative answers, did have maybe 3 or 4 people saying, oh, I wish these heads would just get over themselves and stop moaning and just knuckle down and get on with it. because it were maybe 3 or 4 people out of 700 people that said that. So, you know, our tolerance levels for stress is different, and also the environment in which we're working and the levels of stress that we're experiencing are different for everybody. So I think my message from that is that everybody needs to understand what the symptoms or, you know, kind of red flags, that, as you said, for burnout are, and they need to be able to recognize that in themselves, because, and also not feel ashamed or embarrassed if their tipping point is less than somebody else's tipping point.
Yeah, I think there are two things there. I think the first one is that having time to stop, and one of the reasons that I am such a believer in coaching is because I think coaching gives leaders an opportunity for reflection, for thinking about those things, for thinking about how they're coping, and for thinking about how things are going. And often, I think in the daily busyness of life, senior leaders don't get a lot of time to step back and actually reflect on how things are going for them. And the other thing is, it's a shame thing, and it's a stigma thing, and it's similar to the stigma around mental health. Senior leaders don't want to admit often that they're struggling or that they're having a problem, because often that's they worry that that's then seen as a weakness, don't they? One of the reasons I'm doing a course in January, a resilient leaders program, and the reason I'm doing it is because I want to help leaders build that resilience, because it's a bit of a buzzword at the moment, you're right, isn't it? It's like, you know, what is resilience? How much of it do we have? How can we assess it? How can we know what sort of resilience we have? But I'm thinking about how school leaders can build their resilience, and wondering if you can suggest any ways that they can do that.
Yeah, I just want to pick up on what you said about you know, finding time and not showing weakness and all of those things. I mean, I agree entirely with what you said about coaching. It does provide an opportunity for reflection, and it's an opportunity for someone else to hold a mirror up to you so that you can see what's happening. However, we do have a number of issues there. The first one is, you know, what you just said about not wanting to show weakness, but there are a few other bits and pieces as well, which there's a really interesting article that was published just last month in the Harvard Business Review that calls it self-sabotage. And I think that's also something that's really worth looking into. As far as the strength thing is concerned, you know, I feel sometimes uncomfortable saying this because I don't want to alienate male leaders and male listeners. But the truth is that most of what we've learned about what leadership should look like over decades is because we've watched how male leaders lead. And, you know, there's always been this, the charismatic leader, and this idea that the strong leader who has all of the answers. And let's face it, what we know now about the way that men operate is that that's not real for them either. They have to fake it too. It's not just women who have to fake it, but we've as a result developed a leadership culture where everyone feels that they have to be strong and that vulnerability is something that's actually not acceptable. And the truth is that actually it's quite the opposite, that if you are prepared to show vulnerability as a leader, you will be much more successful, for a whole load of reasons. And that's probably a whole other podcast, you know. And I'm a massive fan of Brené Brown. And if, you know, people go away, Dare to Lead, I think is probably the best book that's ever been written on leadership. And, you know, so I think that if you can be vulnerable as a leader and you can show your vulnerability, first of all, you don't get as emotionally exhausted because you're not pretending all the time. And one of the books that really informed my thesis when I was doing my EdD, is a book called The Managed Heart by a woman called Arlie Hochschild. And I know this sounds weird, but her original research was done with flight attendants. And the fact that flight attendants are working in this kind of stressful environment, but all day they're having to say, "More tea, sir, more coffee, sir," and put on this smile, actually means that they become more emotionally exhausted. And that reminds me a lot of what happens to senior leaders, isn't it? People abuse us all the time, and all we do is smile and nod. So actually that's damaging for us to hide our true kind of responses. And so it's much healthier for us to be honest about the vulnerabilities. But what also happens when you're honest about your vulnerabilities is that you encourage other people to do the same. And so what you're creating in your school is an environment where everyone can be honest about what they're experiencing. And when you do that, you build trust and you build genuine positive relationships upon which you can build a foundation of well-being for everybody. And, you know, that's a whole other podcast as well.
I'm laughing because in the podcast that we've just done this week, that's one of the things that Liz Robson-Kelly talks about. And she says relationships are the foundation for well-being. And it's so true, you know, isn't it?
And what we're in at the moment, we're firefighting, aren't we? We're in a crisis management mode. And so what we're doing is we're trying to find ways to help school leaders to manage stress. But actually, I don't believe in stress management in the normal course of things. What I believe in is building an organisational culture that creates positivity, where people can flourish. And what's interesting, and this is coming in a nice, neat circle now, back to the other thing that you asked me about, is that the way that we build resilience is exactly the same way that we build well-being. The things that help us to be well are the things that help us to be resilient. And research, there's plenty of research from the School of Positive Psychology that supports that. So actually, if I'm looking at creating the right organisational culture and building a positive environment where people are not going to be stressed in the first place, I would use the PERMA model from the School of Positive Psychology. And I don't know whether you're familiar with that or whether the listeners are. But this comes, originally the School of Positive Psychology comes from the University of Pennsylvania. And there are now, you know, maybe five big universities around the world. One of them is in Sydney, the University of East London in the UK, that are really building the research in this field. And psychology, you know, it's probably only 100 or so years old. But up until 20 years ago, psychology was entirely focused upon what's wrong with us and how we fix that. And the School of Positive Psychology, Professor Martin Seligman is the founding father, is all built around, well, what's right with us and what works well and how can we do more of that? And so I've been studying this in a master's in applied positive psychology and so coaching psychology. It's a real mouthful, isn't it? At the University of East London for the last couple of years. And the PERMA model is the kind of foundation of well-being in positive psychology. And, you know, you can read, there's a lot of websites about this, but Martin Seligman wrote the book Flourish, which is all about how we flourish. And the PERMA model is the P stands for positive emotions. The E is engagement. The R is relationships. The M is meaning. And the A is accomplishment. And then they've tacked on an H for health, but that wasn't in the original model.
Right.
Within our daily work, we can experience positive emotions. We can be engaged in what we're doing. We can have strong relationships. We can have meaning in our work, which isn't hard for us as educators. And we can feel a sense of accomplishment. Not only will we experience more well-being, but actually we will also build resilience. And the two things are the same, they go absolutely hand in hand. And so once we're out of this crisis management kind of, you know, hellhole that we're in at the moment, that's what we should be looking to do to build resilience for the next crisis.
I think that's just so important, the idea of the two things being linked. Unless you are well, you cannot be resilient. And so you have to have one if you're going to have the other. I think as senior leaders, like you're saying, with our values and the role that's to do with service, often yes. We're so committed to our roles and to improving outcomes for young people that we're our own worst enemies when it comes to looking after ourselves. And I think a lot of senior leaders want to give more and more and often want to give more than they've got. So how can we support senior leaders to recognize that first of all and to understand that they can't do the job as well as they would like to do if their well-being isn't good
Yeah, there's so much research out there. And, you know, this was really the foundation for my thesis, you know, all those years ago. And it was a real eye-opener for me. Lots of this research actually comes from the United States. So I might refer to principals more than I refer to heads and deputy heads when I'm talking about this. Yes. But there's plenty of research to show. First of all, we know, don't we? We know this already. There's a lot of research from Hattie and from Dylan William and others. We know that the head teacher or the principal or the deputies, the senior leaders, but the head teacher in particular, is second in importance only to the teacher and the quality of the teacher, the quality of the teaching and learning in ensuring successful outcomes for pupils.
Yeah.
We know that. There's plenty of research to show that. And the reasons for that is, you know, think about it. The head teacher is responsible for the recruitment of those teachers, first and foremost, and for the organisational culture that they establish in school that helps them to retain those teachers. The head teacher is also responsible for the performance management, supporting the growth and development of those teachers to make sure that they're able to deliver the quality instruction. The head teacher is also responsible, and the deputy head, for the curriculum and, you know, the way in which the curriculum is going to be used. And obviously in England, unlike in international schools where I've worked, you don't have as much kind of freedom over the curriculum, but nevertheless, there is still a lot of freedom. And then, you know, building those, setting the culture of the school in relation to the students, the pupils, and what's expected from them. That all comes to a large extent from the head.
Yeah.
So the head is a really important, you know, person. What we also know, and this is really important and interesting, is that the school can only be successful if the head is effective and the leadership is stable. And when I say stable, I mean we don't have a constant turnover of heads coming in and out of the school. And what we know about stable leadership is that where we have stable leadership in the school, first of all, well, let's turn that on its head. When a head leaves a school, there's more likely to be a dip in results. And let's face it, that's the bottom line, especially yeah. in a kind of, you know, test-based culture that we have in England. And also, it's when a head leaves, when there's a lot of turnover of heads in a particular school, it's also much harder to implement school improvements successfully and to implement change. And one of the reasons for that is because teachers just tend to wait the head out. Oh, we don't need to bother doing that because they'll leave soon. There's quite a lot of research to show that that happens. You know,
yeah.
So it's really important that we have stable leaders in school, and it's also important that those leaders are effective. And what we know, not just from research into schools, but research into professions in all kind of walks of life, is that people are more likely to leave their job if they're stressed, and they're also more likely to perform less effectively in their job if they're stressed. So if you join all of that together, it's quite clear that the head teacher not being stressed is going to have a lot of impact on the success of the school, you know?
Yeah.
Then there's another thing, which I only learned quite recently. I had a lovely Zoom call a few weeks ago with a psychologist called Neil Froude, and he works in South Wales, and he works with the Welsh Consortia supporting schools with teacher wellbeing and pupil wellbeing. And he told me about this thing called contagion theory. And what that means is that as a leader, our mood and our attitude rubs off on the people around us. And so if the leader is well and happy and positive and energized, then the people around them are more likely to be like that too. And so actually, we have a duty to look after ourselves, not just to ensure that our leadership is stable and our leadership is effective, but also to ensure that we are rubbing off on everyone around us and making sure that our mood and attitude is reflected, not just in the other adults, but in the kids in the building as well. So there's a whole bunch of reasons there why it's actually important that we look after ourselves and that others who are responsible for us, whether that be local government, central government, or governors, support us in looking after ourselves.
So that... it sort of leads me into another question that I had, which was about governors, really. And, because well-being has like moved up the list of important things in schools, and it's definitely on the radar of governors because it's a focus for Ofsted. So it becomes like a number one priority all of a sudden. And I'm not saying that, you know, some governors were interested in it prior to this, to be fair to them. But what role do you think governors have in looking after the welfare and well-being of the senior leaders in their schools? Before we find out more from Helen about what governors can do to support the well-being of headteachers in their schools, I'd just like to talk to you a little bit about our partner, headteacherchat.com. Headteacherchat discusses lots of topics, from how to support pupils with learning, how to support parents, and the many issues that come with leading a school. The aim of Headteacherchat is to support headteachers and school leaders who are in a challenging and often lonely role. They do this by offering lots of information for schools to tap into. For example, they have lots of fantastic education companies on their database for leaders to discover, as well as leadership templates to download. They've written product reviews for leaders who are looking for products for their school. And this year, they've even launched the very first school leader planner, especially designed to help leaders to be productive and organised. If you'd like to hear more about Headteacherchat, you can find them on their website at www.headteacherchat.com. Headteacherchat, it's what headteachers are talking about. Now let's get back to the interview and find out how governors can support headteachers' well-being.
I think it's massive. And I was doing another podcast a few days ago, and I was asked, you know, where have you worked, where you've seen this done well, and what can you tell us about, you know, how that worked? I haven't ever seen it done well. And one of the things that I've really tried to do over the last few years, maybe 5 years, is to try to get governors to listen. And that isn't always very easy. I mean, first of all, let's just say this, first of all, remember governors are volunteers and governors get stressed themselves, and governors are going through a nightmare at the moment, especially chair of governors. They usually have other jobs. They've got families too. And I did actually have one governor say on a Facebook group where I'd shared some of my research, well, you know, I've got no sympathy for the head. They're getting paid big bucks, and I'm doing this for nothing, kind of thing.
Wow.
But there are kind of issues there, you know, relating to the governors, and, you know, they're not trained very well either. So I think we have to sympathise with governors rather than make them the enemy, and try to work with them and understand that we're all in this together. I think the single most important thing that governors need to understand is that there is no one size fits all approach. And the way to make, first of all, they have a massive role to play, but they have to work collaboratively, closely with their head of school in order to make them successful. Because there's no point in coming in and getting advice from someone else who, you know, who's supporting you as a governor, whether that be an organisation or other governors or whatever, and someone telling you, you must do this, and then go into your head and saying, okay, I'm going to do this. And I know that some governors have not had a very kind of friendly response from their heads, and thought, well, I'm trying to help you. And actually, you know, you're not helping yourself. Actually, what you need to do first and foremost is ask your head, what do they need? What's making them stressed? Because what works for one head won't work for another head. You know, so the first thing you need to do is talk with them. Find out what's stressful. Sit down and create an environment in which the head feels that they can make themselves vulnerable. And one of the ways to do that is to make yourself vulnerable. It'd be great as a chair of the governance to say, I'm finding this really stressful too. And then outline all the reasons why it's important that we support your well-being, you know, using all the research that I just kind of shared with you. And then say, what do you need? And then work with them to try to implement the things that their head thinks themselves that they need, rather than just imposing something on them. You know, I do think it's a really good idea to appoint a well-being governor who has a real interest in this, because chairs of governors are very busy people. Mm. And this might not be their field, and they might not feel comfortable about sitting down with somebody and saying, you know, and having somebody cry on their shoulder, or they might feel that they're not the right person who can create that right environment for the head of school to hope to open up.
Yeah.
You know, so it matters that it's the right person. And then there's a whole bunch of things that governors can do. I think the most important thing is finding ways to find time for the head to focus upon their own needs. So can you provide opportunities for them to work from home once a week so that they don't have to do the commute? They're not on the premises having somebody coming into their office every 5 minutes with things that, you know, just that. Yeah.
And that applies to the whole senior leadership team as well, doesn't it?
It applies to deputies as well. But for deputies, it's the head's responsibility to make sure that more than it is the governor's responsibility. But again, can you know, there are lots of ways to make time. It could be a day a week or a day a fortnight working from home. There could be time in lieu offered when you've done lots of evening work or worked a lot of the holidays. Even kind of more big picture thinking, is it possible to find opportunities for the head to take a sabbatical so that rather than having to leave when they're burnt out, the deputy can become an interim and the head can take 3 or 6 months off and then come back refreshed, already knowing the school and knowing the school's needs, rather than having to go out and find somebody else. Is there a way that there can be some kind of special leave where the head can take time off rather than just the odd day here and there? Are there ways in which the head can be relieved of some of their evening duties? So, you know, deputies often, yes, okay, we have to be careful we don't put on them too much, and our senior teachers, because they're very busy, but often they want to be empowered. And wouldn't it be a fantastic idea to let them attend the governor's meeting occasionally? They're going to be ahead one day and they want to find out what goes on in the governor's meeting, and they're going to feel empowered and really chuffed and validated that you asked them. So one of the things that used to kill me was certain times of the year where there were so many evening events, whether it be board meetings, whether it be concerts, parent meeting, you know, parent evenings. And those weeks, I really barely functioned.
I'm going to be honest with you, Helen, and say that that's one of the reasons why I didn't want to be ahead.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I didn't want the pressure. And it's not just going to those events as the head. It's being under pressure to speak at the end of the play, or you have to be up.
And being sociable. You know, and one of the things I've learned about myself, Vicky, over the years, and people will be surprised, you know, people who don't know me well, is that I'm actually an introvert. And you'd be surprised, more leaders are introverts than we really know. And actually, for me, to go to an event and have to smile and glad hand all night is so hard.
Yeah.
It's painful. I just want to go and hide in the toilet, you know, because I really don't enjoy it. And so finding opportunities to share those things. Yeah. Where there might be people in school who actually actively want to do those things. So, you know, those are just some practical things around time. Other things that can be done. Encouraging the head to distribute the leadership better. Like I said, other people want to be empowered, and you need to make sure that we're not putting on people too much. Yeah. Other people are building their careers, and giving them opportunities to do stuff is actually helping them to build their CV and build their skills, you know. Professional coaching and counselling is another thing. And then moving on in a different world to the world we're in now, to focus upon that, encouraging the head to build the right kind of organisational culture so that everybody can thrive. I think other things that governors can do, working in collaboration, maybe with local authorities and other boards of governors of other schools and trade unions, is building up those peer networks, so that heads and deputies have other heads and deputies that they can talk to.
Yeah.
And maybe even bringing in coaching training for networks of heads, so that they actually have formal training to enable them to coach each other in a very safe environment. You know, so I think there's lots and lots of things that governors can do there, either on their own or in collaboration with other organisations.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely great, very, very useful advice and very insightful. I think the thing that makes me think about is that the governors create the climate in the way that they work with the head, and then the head takes that into the school and creates the climate then with the senior leadership team. So like you're saying, things like sharing and spreading the load and things like that, that the head takes that from the, takes the lead from the governors.
Absolutely. And then what the governors need to do is create a culture and an expectation of self-care. So it's not this is an option, it's that we expect this from you, it's your duty. In order that you can maximize your potential as a leader, we expect you to attend to your well-being, and we expect you there. And then the head can take into school that message to the deputies and to the other, you know, the teachers within the school, that we expect you to attend to your well-being. Now, we have to be careful about the way we use language.
Yeah,
we want it to be another hoop that people are jumping through and another box to be ticked. You've got to create the right environment where that can happen. You know, I've heard about people having to have a well-being target on their performance management, and they're just like, I'm not sure about that. You know, that's just to beat you with, isn't it?
I think it's really difficult, and I think there's a real struggle going on with heads, and many heads are, their heart is in the right place when it comes to supporting the well-being of their staff. I think they're just, it's such a huge beast that often heads don't really know what to do for the best. And I think you said before, and I think you hit the nail on the head when you said no one size fits all. So so somebody might want, it might work for somebody to finish at 3 o'clock on a Friday and not work at the weekends. It might work for someone else to work every Saturday morning because, you know, I think I would give the advice, don't work at weekends. But some people want to do that because they've spent their evenings doing other things. Some people will say, I really like working 50 hours a week because that's where I, that's my passion and that's where I get my drive and my, so it's really difficult because there are so many, it's a personal thing. It's like differentiating learning for children, isn't it? It's,
but, you know, let's say you've got 50 teachers in your school, you're like differentiating 50 ways. You know, and this is the same principle as the principle I discussed with you about how do governors support head teachers. You know, and I said, well, ask them what they want. It's the same with teachers, but you need to do that in a more formalized way, because you can't go around asking in every individual what they want. You know, so the starting point for teacher well-being is to do a survey. And, you know, there are a lot of these around. You get free ones, you can also pay for them. And what you really need to do, you know, I'm a great believer in data, but data is only useful if you do something with it, isn't it? Otherwise you do a survey, and then what are you going to do with your survey? So, you know, a lot of the professional development and the inset that I do is built around this. It's first of all, let's do a survey, and let's then develop two things. One, we develop an action plan for the whole school, but we also have each individual teacher develop their own action plan. And so at the end of the inset, they've got something that they can take away with them, that they can work on, that they've devised themselves. So what I'm doing through that session is, first of all, sharing with them lots of information about what stress is and what causes teachers to be stressed and all of that stuff. And then we start looking at, well, what's making me stressed? And they can figure out what their stresses are. And then we look at ways in which we can manage stress. So we're looking at active coping strategies rather than passive coping strategies, which is drinking too much booze and eating too much food and taking drugs or gambling or spending too much at the shops or whatever. And you give them a whole smorgasbord of ideas of things that might work. And they identify the things that they think are going to work for them. And then they have a plan that they can take away that's tailored to their needs. Because let's face it, if you come in and say, okay, well, we're all going to start doing mindfulness, which is what happens, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's going to be a whole bunch of people. You know, the School of Positive Psychology has shown that mindfulness is by far the most evidence-based effective practice for managing stress. But actually, in reality, it isn't effective, because the truth is that only about 15% of people keep it up once they've started it. So actually, it's not effective.
And a lot of people are cynical about it as well, aren't they? If you try doing that with the whole staff, I imagine quite a number of them would be sitting there going, why am I having to sit here, do this? I've got X amount of things to do.
To make a whole staff all sit there and close their eyes and stuff. I mean, I've been made to do that. It was a long time ago. You know, and I am actually a 200-hour yoga teacher. And
I noticed that, yeah.
You know, it's not that I don't believe in all of that. I absolutely do, but it's not going to work in that kind of environment. And at my last school, I actually found money to support a mindfulness professional learning community, because they came to me and said, we want to do this. Will the school support us? And yeah, they built up over a period of years so that eventually we had about 25 staff who were doing it. But it wasn't something we made them do. It was something they wanted to do.
And so one of the things I find or have found with senior leaders and staff is that one of the things they'll say is, well, I don't have time for that. I've got so much to do that I don't have time. I find it really sad when people say, well, I don't have time to go to the gym. I'm up at six. I'm in work at seven. And
I had a few people on the survey who said they didn't have time for any of this. When I asked them about what coping strategies were you using, well, I don't have time for any coping strategies. Yeah. I don't even want to drink too much or eat too much. I just come home and go to bed, you know. And that's why you need an individual plan, an individual well-being plan, because it helps you to reflect on your unhealthy practices and to make some kind of commitment to yourself, not to anybody else who can enforce it, just to yourself. But it's interesting because this kind of circles back now to one of the things we discussed near the beginning, and I mentioned that phrase, self-sabotage.
Yeah.
So one of the most important things that senior leaders can do is to think about, well, when I say I don't have time, is that true, or am I actually really sabotaging myself?
Yeah.
And in this article that I mentioned earlier from the Harvard Business Review, I think there were 5 self-sabotage techniques, if you like. And I must admit, I recognised some of them in myself from my, you know, my days as a school leader coming up to the burnout. One of them is perfectionism. You know, are you setting standards for yourself that are too high? And I know one of the things that we say as school leaders is, I have high expectations of the kids. I have high expectations of the teachers, but I have the highest expectations of myself. But are the expectations that we have too high? Do we have to be perfect? You know,
yeah.
Another one is a sense of over-responsibility. Do you feel responsible for everything that happens in that school, regardless of whether or not you've got any control over it? You know, and there are several others that we need to explore. Do we need to be this perfect, on the ball person all the time? The other thing that I recognized in myself, and it took counseling to help me to recognize this, was that was I working so hard because I was seeking too much validation through my work? And that goes things that happened in my childhood. And I started realizing that actually I was trying to prove something. And I think maybe that happens with women leaders more, especially because we found the route to leadership so hard, yeah, to break through that glass ceiling. And then somehow we get into this habit, this loop of working, of overworking, you know.
I think as women, we do have the struggle, don't we? I found the struggle of looking after the children and being the main caregiver and having to do the role as well was difficult. I think one of the things you just mentioned with counselling and coaching, I think they are definitely part of the solution for senior leaders. And I think that I think governors and heads need to understand that there is an investment that you need to make in terms of well-being, and that is time and budget. And I think unless you acknowledge that, if you are going to create a culture of well-being in your school where there is a broad range of things available to staff, including counselling, including coaching, it's going to cost, and part of that cost comes from allowing staff the time, and I think that's a really important acknowledgement to make, that it is an investment, and it's something that you really have to commit to over quite a long period of time.
Totally agree. You know, I mean, I went to counselling because I got to a beyond coaching point, you know, where I had an occupational burnout. But coaching can stop you getting to that point. But there's no doubt that coaching can be very expensive. Now there are some, you know, the beginnings of some programs that are being piloted. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with Viv Grant, Integrity Coaching. You know, she was at the, she was the person that was kind of really out there with coaching. And I have a lot of respect for the work that she's done, but she's been working, I think, with the National Association for Head Teachers. And there's a lot of work that trade unions and other organisations that support us, in addition to the local authority, can do in helping to defray the cost. Now, I mentioned earlier Neil Froude down in South Wales and the work that he's doing. But interestingly, I then noticed that Education Support have just in the last week started advertising a pilot scheme that they're doing for Welsh head teachers, where they can get a course of 6 free coaching sessions as a pilot. Right. And I know that Viv Grant also did some research that she has published about the effectiveness of coaching and what a good investment it is. But there are beginning to be bits of things going on out there, you know, that firstly prove what an investment it is, so that that document can then be taken to, you know, governors or local authorities or whoever's running, responsible for running your school, to prove that this investment works, but also helping to defray the cost by some of that cost being carried by other organisations. Yeah. Outside of the school. But there's no doubt that ring fencing a budget for wellbeing has to be a good investment. You know, I only worked in schools in the UK, in England, for 2 years, but it was at the time when ICT was really taking off, and I was the coordinator for ICT, and we had money ring fenced for ICT. And you know, we had to spend it on, in the old days, CD-ROMs and all these kinds of things, and we were not allowed to spend it on anything else. So if we could do that, why can't we ring fence money for wellbeing? So that you can't spend it on something else. You have to ring fence it. You know, so there are lots of ways of doing that, either by ring fencing within a school's budget or by looking to other organisations that are responsible for supporting schools. And, you know, or even, as I mentioned earlier, what about bringing heads together and deputies together from the local area and investing in some coaching training for them so that they can coach each other? Yeah. And then you've got something that's actually more sustainable than one-to-one coaching.
Yeah, but one of the things that I do is a women leaders coaching program in schools. So I teach the women how to coach. They have coaching with me as part of the program, and then they coach each other. And then hopefully I'm going to, the next step will be to do a master coaches program for some of those women leaders who've really developed a passion for it, so that they can then teach my program in their schools and it can become a self-sustaining program. It's been so fantastic to talk to you, Helen. I could talk to you all day. But thanks so much for coming on the show. If people want to find you, where can they find out more about you and what you do and possibly using your services?
Yeah, so I have a blog. It's drhelenkelly.com. The blog is called The Positive Principle.
And it's brilliant. I've read all.
You can find me on LinkedIn. If you go to my blog, there's a contact page. I don't have a page of these are my services, because I want people to come to me. You know, I'm not touting for business. I want people that really feel that they need
this. Oh, we've lost you again.
Oh, I was saying, I want people who really feel they need their services to come and find me.
Yeah.
You know, so go on the contact page, or I hang out on LinkedIn. I'm also hanging out on a lot of Facebook pages for school leaders in England. And you'll see me posting to those pages. I post to my blog every week. Yeah. Those are 3 places that you can find me. I'm out there. I'm not
brilliant.
Hard to find.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. Hopefully we'll get to speak to you again in the future.
I'd love that.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Bye-bye.
I want to say a big thank you to Dr. Helen Kelly for taking the time to come on the show today and share her expertise and knowledge and the research that she's done. I was really interested in what she had to say about burnout, as obviously I've told you many times about my own experiences of burnout. But the idea that we can spot some of the signs before we actually reach that point, I think is really important. And it's really necessary to be aware of yourself, be aware of what's happening to you, and make sure that you look after yourself so that you can spot those signs if they are there. And she's written some very interesting blogs on her the Positive Principle website that you can access and have a look at, and I would highly recommend that you do that. The other thing that I think really comes across in the interview is the idea, and we've explored this in other interviews in the past, and it's the idea that there isn't one size that fits all, that well-being is a very personal thing. And the question that needs to be asked is, what do you need? Governors need to ask that of head teachers. Head teachers need to ask that of their senior leadership teams. And we need to find out, and there are ways to find this out in schools, what individual members of staff need. And Helen took us through some of the different ways that we can do that, and I hope that you'll find that helpful and that you'll be able to implement some of those things in your own school. The other thing that Helen really discussed with us is the idea of the role of governors and the chair of governors and a wellbeing governor in creating the right organisational culture in a school in which every member of the community can thrive. And the one thing that she said was that there needs to be, from the governors, an expectation of self-care on the head teacher. And then that will filter down from the head teacher to the staff. And obviously, that has to be supported by the environment in which you're working within the school. But I was listening to a podcast just the other day that I found very interesting. And instead of calling looking after yourself self-care, it was a different phrase of self-compassion. And I think the idea of us being more kind to ourselves is an important one, but having that expectation of staff of self-care or self-compassion is really important. She also came up with some really innovative and fresh approaches to how heads can be supported or how senior leaders in schools can be supported. For example, when she talked about time in lieu for evening work or offering sabbaticals to head teachers, I think these are, you know, very cutting edge innovative ideas, but I really think that they could work in schools to avoid heads or senior leaders reaching burnout, being able to spread the load of all that extra work that senior leaders and heads are doing could make a really big difference. And finally, Helen talked about building up peer networks, and this is something that has come up repeatedly on the show, the idea of heads having a supportive network within which they can feel supported and be vulnerable as well, and ask questions and be curious and find out answers to things that they need to know. She also talked about coaching for heads and leaders, and potentially coaching groups of heads who could coach each other. And I think this is a really interesting idea. And one of the reasons that I got into coaching in the first place is because I got to the point of burnout and I didn't have the opportunity to access quality coaching in time to save myself as a deputy head. And that's why now, as a coach, I want to help other leaders, head teachers, so that they don't get to that point of burnout themselves. So if you're interested in finding out how I could coach you or how I could work at your school to support the creation of a coaching culture, you can have a look at my website at www.transformeducationcoach.com. And I'm also on LinkedIn and Facebook and Twitter, so you can reach out to me via any of those social media places. Thank you for listening to the first show of the year. Like I said, we've got some really interesting guests coming up, one of them being the co-writer of the book Putting Teachers First, Johnny Utley, so look out for that episode coming soon. That's all we've got time for today. Thanks for listening. Take care of yourself, take care of your staff, and lead well. This episode of the We Lead Well podcast was brought to you in partnership with Transform Education Coaching, headteacherchats.com, and the Teach Well Alliance.